Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Cathode Ray Mission. I'm your host, Adam Ferens, and tonight we're looking at the works of Peter Watkins, a British director best known for films such as War Game, Edward Munch, and Punishment Park. He is equal parts documentarian, theorist, and dramatist. He's had a hell of a long career in film and television. Joining me tonight for discussion of this career are Aaron White. Say hello.
Hello.
And Carl Kafer. Say hello.
C'est la vie.
So, you know, I always like to ask this question first. And I'll start with you, Carl. How do we first come to the works of Peter Watkins?
Okay, so I'd read about the War Game for ages. I knew that it was banned by the BBC, that it won the Oscar and was released, but it had never been released after that, and that was, what, 66, I think. So I'm in New York in the mid-80s, and it shows up at a repertory theater with Culloden. And you could like go into War Game first and then Culloden, or go into Culloden and see War Games. They were playing them both on the same screen. And I went in and I saw War Games and I was destroyed. I couldn't even, I had to get out of there. I was just devastated. And this was actually after, like, the day after. So this was past that. And this just, like, blew me the fuck away. So that's how I got to know Watkins. And then from there on, anything I could see, and particularly, well, we'll get into it. Anything I could see, I would see. I mean, it just absolutely blew me away. That's how I got to know.
So, you know, for me, the way I got into him is I had been aware of some of the work, but I did not get to see any of it until I began my TV project. So this was about maybe 9-10 years ago now. And what I saw was Culloden followed by War Game. And, you know, they were unique and they were compelling, and while War Game did not destroy me, it was definitely something when you think about when it was made and when it should have originally been released, because there's a whole big story there. Yeah, that's quite a statement. I followed up with several other of his works within short order, but that's how I began, and did it on the recommendation of a friend, and I'm glad I did. So, Aaron, how did you come to Peter Watkins?
I knew about the War Game for a long time before I was able to see it, because, spoiler alert, his films are not easy to come by in America. You pretty much have to buy imported discs in order to see them. I think there's a couple of boutique discs of, like, War Game and Culloden, and there's Privilege, but I think the rest of them really are imports.
Yeah, pretty much.
But you got talking about doing this show, and I finally went ahead and tracked them all down. Not all of them. Because even in import form, some of them are still very difficult to come by. But I tracked several down. And, yeah, I watched War Game first, and it's a bummer.
it's the happiest movie ever made.
is, which is one of, also one of his more accessible films.
You don't say. Yeah, no, ladies and gentlemen, if you're wondering, you know, what this all means, those of you who may not be familiar with Watkins' work, he is probably just as much a theorist and a philosopher as he is a dramatist. His works are very much documentary in style, if not in fact. They're compelling, usually, but they're not for wide audiences in terms of, you know, this is not something that Joe Sixpack is going to be able to sit down after watching Monday Night Football and enjoy. Given that, you know, Joe Sixpack's probably going to have imbibed a few beers, that's not going to work with this. So I will ask you the next question, and that is, what theme or themes most pervade Watkins' work? Aaron?
They were just very urgent films of the moment, I think. They're very much of the political moment. So you have these ideas of impending fascism, and you have the idea of the bomb, obviously. But I really think that that idea of the docudrama that really, I mean, Ken Russell invented in his BBC days, that Watkins really took a step farther. I think that style is more important here than maybe theme or content, because I think that he's choosing to make these films either documentaries or faux documentaries in order to really hammer home the point that even if this isn't real, it could be. I like to call them speculative documentaries, for whatever that's worth. Without getting too much into individual films, I think that the idea of the loss of freedom and the idea of a fascist takeover is really at the heart of a lot of his, at least, best work.
Carl, what's yours?
Well, I think if you take a look at most of his early stuff, and there are two themes that come by. You know, it's certainly political, but in most of them, it's about the overstep of the government or the complete idiocy of the government. He's very anti-government. Extremely. And he shows, you know, governments taking over and dystopian. And I always called his style dystopian documentaries. You know, futurological. You know, he's looking at things like that. And the other thing that comes to mind, too, is that he very, very much is in step with the downtrodden, with the people that don't have enough, and that the rich and that, and there's that social sense too that comes through everything. You know, if you don't have enough food, if you don't have this, or you're against the government, you're going to get, you know, trodden on, and you're going to get destroyed. And so you know, there's this very anti-authoritarian bent to his work, which I really can connect with. So I would say anti-authoritarianism.
Mm-hmm.
Do you agree or not agree?
Well, there's that, but, you know, he also, Watkins, that is, Watkins is known for putting forth a theory that he has called, it's ideas about a media hegemony, which he calls the monoform. And it's basically about the lack of debate around the construction of new forms of audiovisual media and discussions, and this is where you guys come in, discussions in those media of the very things you were saying you were seeing. So Watkins is, of course, trying to break out of the monoform with his films and point toward, well, something, shall we say. I think we'll come to that a little bit later. I don't want to spoil exactly what I think it is. But I do think that, you know, we covered Terrence Malick recently, and he, you know, Carl, you kept referring to him as the philosopher filmmaker. And I would say that he's definitely one of them. Watkins comes close, but but his philosophy is not the same type of philosophy as what you find in, say a Malick. Watkins' whole method of argumentation and showing it, displaying it, is quite different from most other filmmakers. I mean, he's very unique, very unique. So, you know, moving on to the next question, I do want to ask this one. And it ties into this, and it is this. It is Watkins more of a documentarian or a philosopher, or is he something else entirely? And I'll say with you, Carl.
Well, I tell you what, if he's a philosopher, to me, he shows what he thinks is going to happen. But I do find him as a theorist and basically very, very much connected to McLuhan. If you look at his style and what he does with the media and how he presents his films, you know, he has this sort of sense of both documentary and realism, but yet they're not real events. And so he's making comments that you're watching something that's not real, but it feels real because I'm doing this in this style. And the new film that I saw that she sent me even breaks that even more apart, because in that particular one, Free Thinker, you know, he's talking about Strindberg, and he uses like a play, photographs. There's actually, you know, breakups of them filming, and you see the film equipment and so on and so forth. So he's challenging what we consider, you know, a movie. What is this? And I think that is where he really is questioning. It's not so much that he has a philosophy like, you know, Malick, because Malick's very
right.
much a humanist. It's more like he's questioning what media is in a lot of ways by the way he presents it. But he doesn't push it on you. You know, he pushes his political beliefs a lot more. He's a very unique director in that case and filmmaker. And so I think he's more of a theorist in that terms than a philosopher. Okay. So, I mean, that's the best I can come up with. He's very hard to explain.
Oh, that's great. Absolutely. Absolutely. So, Aaron, your thoughts here?
I think if there was such a thing as a science fiction documentarian, he'd be it.
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt. I was going to hold off on that, but you're absolutely right. No question.
He's also pure postmodernism, right? Like Carl was saying, he likes to ask the question, like, how does the media work? And in this case, the media being, like, the medium. How does film work? How does film make my audience feel what I need them to feel so that they know how urgent this is?
Well, look at what Punishment Park is about, you know?
Right, exactly. Punishment Park is a pure science fiction film, and people won't realize, because it's so gritty and down to earth, just how science fiction it is. But anytime you deal with alternate histories or alternate realities, you're obviously dealing with science fiction. And it's just documenting the things that he doesn't want to happen, but things
right.
that he thinks could if something goes just a little bit more wrong than it's currently going.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that does it. So my next question will be to you, Aaron, and that is, who do you think his most important collaborator is?
This one took me a while. Because he doesn't work with a lot of people a lot. But Peter Sosnetsky, who also worked with David Cronenberg and Ken Russell, was the DP on both Privilege and Gladiators. But just as important as the fact that it's somebody who he actually worked with twice, he, I think, was very influenced by the Ken Russell BBC documentaries. And in turn, I think that he had a large influence on David Cronenberg. So I think that passing of the same DP down that line is really interesting. So.
Carl?
Well, I really don't have an answer for this. I would say that certainly I think BBC documentaries and Russell. And Sosnetsky, that's a good, you know, we worked with him twice. But he doesn't really work with anyone. I think, if anything, if you take a look, you know, it's what he did. You know, he was in the National Service, and he studied acting, and then he began his career as assistant producers of short films and commercials, an editor, and I think it was just the people he worked with at the BBC and how it all just sort of coagulated into making him who he is. I mean, he certainly has had influence on people, but I can't really, you know, say who influenced him or who his best collaborator is. I really can't answer that. Sorry.
No, that's fair enough. So actually, I'll stick with you then, Carl, and ask this question, finally. Where does he fit with other British directors of his period? You know, the ones that came up at the same time.
Well, you know, this I've had this question, and I actually am going to ask a question of the two of you. Okay, because the person that I connect him with more than anyone else, though they seem to be very separate in how they approach things to a certain degree, is Peter Greenaway. And I've always felt that there's some sort of connection there. Though I can't.
I'm surprised you didn't say Lindsay Anderson.
Not so much Lindsay. To me, it's more Peter Greenway. Certainly,
they're
Lindsay,
both very stylized in their own way.
You know, but Lindsay was much more humanist, and was much more interested in how life affected this one person and how he adapted. Whereas, you know, the connection between who said it, between Watkins and Cronenberg. You know, I mean, they both have this eye, this very, very much medical eye sense of you know, stepping back and just observing, whereas Anderson was much more interested in the inner workings of the person that's being affected. But to me, Greenway is more of a connection, because Greenway sort of like blends that to a certain degree. But that's the one that I find, and I can't really put my finger on it. I was thinking about this today, but you take a look at, you know, you know, the cook, the wife, and you see all this, but he has this, you know, belly of an architect. He steps back. He just shows you what's happening. He doesn't really get into. But that to me is the person that I connect him most with. And Russell, I mean, Russell certainly had an effect on him in terms of the documentaries, but not so much the feature films. So that's what I would say.
Yeah, you know, I have to say, you know, I have not seen as much Greenway as I probably should. And you know, while I know that Thief is probably his most acclaimed work, the one that I enjoyed the most was Drafton's Contract. I thought that was a powerful movie.
I love Drafton's Contract too.
You know, that is something that I'm going to have to think on, because I've really only seen about 3 or 4 Greenway films. Interesting. So now we come to that final part. Usually, we do this as a countdown.
Hey, by the way, I don't think you asked Aaron that question.
No, we didn't. I'm so sorry. I am so sorry, guys. I was like, I'm finally going to get through the show without skipping somebody, and I have to say,
I was rolling with
it. I am so sorry.
I mean, if we're being honest, this is like the best period of British cinema, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
With the guys coming up through this period. And I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's stuff from the 60s.
I really am.
From like 57
Peter
to
Watkins,
83. Yeah.
Peter Watkins just doesn't stack up against the rest of the new British cinema. He's interesting. He's compelling in his own ways, but he's not Ken Loach. He's not Mike Lee. He's not like Lindsay
Ken
Anderson,
Russell.
Ken Russell.
He's not even Alan Clark.
I appreciate what he did, and I think a lot of the statements he made are important, but I think that he could have said them better filmically than he did.
Yeah. No, I think he's important, but I will have to agree with you there, Aaron, and I do apologize for almost skipping over you. Because you basically nailed my own feelings. He's someone I respect. He's someone who's made several films that I really love, but you know, who in context, specifically in context of his immediate contemporaries, you know, I can probably name 5 to 10 other British directors that I think are better and more important than he is. That's not to say that he doesn't have his own place or his own importance, but, you know, when I think about Watkins, I think of him in terms of, well, as Carl's put it, as being a theorist, you know, particularly what he's done in the last 20 or 30 years since he's pretty much quit making movies. His contributions and writings on media, I think, are more fascinating than a majority of his films. So there you go.
Okay, I need to jump in here and just say, for the record, he's in my top 20 directors. Easily. I think the man is the most underrated, most unknown British director out there, and everybody should watch every fucking thing he's ever done, which I still haven't done. So, you know, seriously.
Well, I still think everybody needs to see Alan Clark, because when they say that television has never had a director with their own voice, they haven't seen an Alan Clark film.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. Clark is another one that I think is forgotten, or not forgotten, but sort of like undervalued. But for me, I agree. But for me, Watkins
very undervalued.
It hits me in
but
the
no,
solar
that's not to slag Watkins at all. You know, we wouldn't be doing this show tonight
if I didn't think
spotlight. But you know, I do think that Aaron does have a good point, that there are other directors that you can place above him in terms of his contemporaries and in terms of you know, the space they found in the culture, their impact, all that. Now, in terms of whether or not one prefers that or thinks that makes them better, that's where the arguments can come in, and that's what makes all of this very, very fun. That's why we do these shows, to have these conversations. But now I will go back to, as I was saying before, we come to the part where we are going to do our top five. Usually I do this with three or four guests, and we do it as the old Siskel and Ebert countdown, where we all list our number 5, 4, 3, 2, and finally build up to number 1. Well, tonight it's going to be just a little different. And tonight, how I think I want to do this is I'm going to have us, I'll ask one of you your top 5, and I'll ask the other one your top 5, and we'll talk about them. So I will start with you, Carl. From number 5 to number 1, what are your top 5 Watkins films?
Okay. Number 5, Gladiator Renra, or The Gladiator. Okay.
Yeah.
Number 4, Edvard Munch. Number 3, surprise, Privilege. Number 2 and 1, Fight It Out every fucking day for me. And you can basically just, whatever day it is, it's either Punishment Park at number 2 or War Game at number 2. And then the other one, number 1.
Yeah. Yeah, no, those are all excellent films. You know, when I saw Gladiatorama, which I hadn't seen until I was prepping this show. That's a powerful little movie.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and Punishment Park, which I hadn't seen in nearly a decade, that holds up so well. Jesus Christ, that holds up so well. It really, really does. It really, really does. And we'll get into some discussion on that, because we can't avoid that film. But what about you, Aaron? What are your top 5 Watkins?
Number 5 is Privilege. 4, Culloden. 3, The Gladiators. 2 War Game, and 1 is Punishment Park.
Yeah. Yeah, I would probably have to go somewhere with that. You know, I really, really admire War Game a lot. And sometimes War Game is my number 5, and sometimes it's my number 6. But damn, Privilege is excellent. And I really, really like Culloden. I might be a little biased toward Culloden because, you know, when I got to see Culloden and War Game, I got to see Culloden first, so Culloden was my first walk-ins. But, you know, I was just struck by the way that he presented it and how it did feel as if there actually had been a crew talking to soldiers during the American Revolution. It's quite remarkable. I mean, you know these are actors playing roles, and yet it feels like what would have happened. And that is fucking phenomenal. It's truly remarkable. And you know, Watkins is one of the most unique filmmakers of the last 60 years. I have no qualms saying that. You know, it's not because he does movies that you know, he decided to shoot it on a fisheye lens through worm guts in half light in his mother's basement, or some weird shit like that. But just he does very unique work. He does work that you see it and you're like, yep, only Watkins would do that. And whether that's a good or a bad thing, I'll let others judge, but I'm glad that he did them. I'm glad they exist for public consumption. So now I will ask the question that I always like to ask at the end, and that is this one. Is there anything that we have not talked about Watkins that you'd like to talk about before we go to housekeeping? And I'll go with you, Carl. Is there anything that we haven't brought up that you'd like to bring up before we go?
Well, you know, I think, you know, we ought to at least mention, you know, do a quick talk about the main films.
We could.
You know, we haven't done that. For example, Privilege is his only film that's, quote, a feature film.
True. Because the rest of them are very long.
That was the only time he did that.
TV films, mostly.
Right. You know, the other thing that was touched upon very briefly was he's really, in many ways, a science fiction filmmaker. You know,
yes,
four of the 6 films we mentioned are dystopian. You know, even War Games, you can consider that dystopian.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and that's something that we really haven't talked about is has he had any real influence in terms of, you know, filmmakers? And not just science fiction filmmakers, but filmmakers in general, has you know, he influenced other people, which is a general question you ask. You know, I mean, I think he deserves a little more talk here instead of just going right into housekeeping.
I wanted to see who had something to add and if you were interested in going there.
Okay, you're breaking up a little bit, Adam.
No, sorry, my phone crackled there on that end. No, I said that's why I asked the question. I wanted to see if anyone else was interested in going there.
Adam,
so,
call back in. We can't even understand you.
You can't hear me now?
I can hear you just fine, Adam. Adam,
yeah,
I can hear you just fine.
Yeah, you're better.
It's your phone, Carl.
No, that's not my phone. Trust me, I know.
I can hear him.
Everyone else can hear me.
It was crackling. Yeah, I got you now.
For a second. So, as I said, that's why I asked the question. I wanted to see if anyone else wanted to go into a deeper discussion of certain films and traits in his work. So we'll put that aside now that we know we want to go there. What about you, Aaron? Is there anything else you'd like to go into before we wrap this up?
No, not specifically.
So, Carl, I'll let you start. You mentioned his, you know, how Privilege is essentially his only feature film. And,
right.
You know, because he mostly did either little hour films, 75-minute TV-type films, or he did these gigantic 5 to 20-hour works. There was really no middle ground, Privilege aside. And the question I'm going to ask here is, why do you think he did it? I think I know why he did it, but why do you think he chose to do that?
Well, he was, you know, there was the War Game and there was Culloden, and he was considered very much an anti-establishment person. And, of course, in the 60s, particularly in Britain, but also here in the U.S., that they were trying, the studios were trying to get in on that particular sense. He comes up with this idea, which is very, very much dystopian and in terms of the rock star who is being controlled by the church and the government to do whatever they want. And, I mean, it was, to me, I think it's the first one that did that, but you've got Wild in the Streets in the U.S. and things like that. The whole idea of the young people taking over, but in this case, young people being corrupted by the government and by the church. And it's very, very nasty. And it's really well done. Paul Jones, a singer, I think, was Man for Man. But, it just didn't resonate with the critics or the people. But that's why he did it, because they thought it'd be a great idea to do, and they would make money at it. And I thought he'd be the right person for it.
So, you know, I want to get back to something here, though, but it's making me think about this. You know, I mentioned earlier how Munch is often the film that people point to with Watkins as his best work, his most important work, his most famous work. I don't think it is his most famous work because War Game exists.
yeah. I agree.
I don't think it's his best work because Punishment Park and Culloden and War Game are a thing and Privilege is a thing. You know, I want to ask, why do you guys, and I'll start with you, Aaron, why do you think Munch, which is a fine work, don't get me wrong, why do you think Munch has captured so much critical and popular thought, in at least in terms of recent discourse on Watkins? You know, when you do see people mention Watkins and they say, oh, yeah, he's the guy that did Munch, why do you think that is?
I think because biopics, whatever, however you want to pronounce it, are things that get easy acclaim. And it's something totally different. Like, for him to get this much attention for a movie that is totally different from, you know, the rest of his entire body of work is almost silly. And I don't know.
And it reminds me so much of what Rossellini did on TV and what Ken Russell did at the BBC, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good... Okay, really is maybe a bit over the top. It's a good biopic. It's a good TV movie. I don't know why it's gotten. Maybe it's because people love The Scream, right? Maybe it's because they love the painting and they want to know more about the artist. I can't explain the phenomenon around this movie.
You know, I think it's a bad film? No, God, no. But I got into a really interesting discussion a few years ago when I suggested that I far preferred Culloden. And, oh, man, this is on a discussion board that's devoted exclusively to arts and entertainment. And someone had posted a review of Munch, and they called it unassailably, inarguably, Watkins' finest achievement. And I just, you know, I mean, everybody's entitled to their opinion, but inarguable.
Mm-hmm.
No one can have a different opinion. You know, maybe water is wet. You can't argue that the sun is a source of heat, that ice is cold. You know, there are certain things that you don't argue with. But, you know, it's not that it's the most important thing, but it's just, it's when I started noticing this real reassessment of Munch, and I had seen it, and I kept thinking to myself, yeah, you know, it's good, but, you know, Rossellini's works are more exciting in terms of the biopics, and Russell's best work at the BBC was more daring in terms of form. You know, I just find Munch to be maybe his most conventional work, and I wonder if perhaps that is why it is starting to get some acclaim or some notice, because people don't know how to access his other works. It may be it's his most accessible, and maybe that's why people don't talk about the other works, because they're too hard to process, they're too
mm-hmm.
dense, and, you know, even though it's 5 hours long, it's still fairly straightforward. It's not this weird documentary of soldiers in, what was it, 1761, or whatever the hell Culloden was, 1749. You know, it's not a hellish nightmare of a post-apocalyptic world. It's not some kid and his mother sitting in a bunker waiting for the end of the world. It's not a bunch of kids getting murdered in the desert by a fascist police force. It's just the story of a painter.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you have that exactly right. It's accessible. It's easy to process. And I think it's absolutely a fantastic film, but it's nowhere near his best, and certainly nowhere near his most interesting in terms of form or things like that.
No.
But it's really and yes, I also think it's The Scream, and that's not, of course, you know, what Craven we're talking about. We're talking about Edvard Munch, and I think people are, you know, how many times have you seen that painting copied and made fun of and so on and so forth? You know, even Warner Brothers did it, cartoons.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, you know, I have a little story about The Scream that I have to say. I actually saw it when they brought all the different versions of The Scream when they were touring them to, like, 5 museums in the world, and it was finally the Museum of Modern Art in New York's moment to have them. They had it for like 2 weeks or something. It was not there very long, but I got a chance to see it. There is something it is one of the few paintings that I've seen where seeing it in person absolutely, totally changes it. Most paintings, it does change it. But there is something unsettling about the Scream when you see it in person as opposed to just seeing a picture of it. And I don't know how to explain it. But I don't know if you got a chance to see that exhibit, Carl, but I know that you were in New York at the same time. So did you?
I did not get to see that, unfortunately.
Yeah. Too bad, because that was you know, I didn't expect to have that response. You know, there I am. I've waited through line, and all of a sudden I get this uneasy feeling. I'm like, that's fucked up. Holy shit. And I wasn't the only person that was obviously having that response to these sets of paintings, you know?
Yeah. Well, absolutely.
But maybe that's also a bit of what Watkins does, you know? You can talk, you know, until you've seen the rest of it, you're not really going to understand it. You know, until you decide to tackle all, what is it, 15 to 20 hours of the journey? His film about climate change and nuclear proliferation. Because, yeah, folks, that was a thing he did. He also did one about the Bastille and... Yeah, it just goes on and on. So is there anything else you'd like to add here, Carl, any more of his films you'd like to talk about briefly?
Yeah, I mean, we could talk about like all of them, but I think we've given it an idea. Just real quickly, The Gladiators. I love the fact that it's basically The Hunger Games, and I always thought that The Hunger Games, basically, somebody had to have watched The Gladiators.
Oh, I wouldn't doubt the lady that wrote the books is a huge, huge movie fan. Huge movie fan. So it wouldn't surprise me if she'd come across it. But stories like that had been, you know, there had been stories about that sort of thing before. But,
The tenth victim, there's been stuff like that before. I agree.
But the fact that they'd been each taken from their specific community to represent that specific community, there are some more direct correlations between Hunger Games and Punishment Park. Not Punishment Park, sorry, I meant Gladiators. I was thinking Punishment Park because I really love that movie. That's my favorite of all of his work. Just a slip of the tongue there. And you know, Gladiators, it's a great little movie. But did it influence Hunger Games? I would bet money. I would bet money that Collins knew, you know, that she'd read up on it, that she had seen the film, and she went, huh? You know, that's not a bad idea.
I'm not accusing her.
I'm not accusing her of plagiarism or anything. That's not it at all.
No.
I would never accuse that. But I could definitely, you know, see one artist being inspired by another and saying, huh, what if these were kids that were being forced into this by their government, and this is the thing, and this is the thing, and, you know, there's all this other stuff. And honestly, you know, I'm not the biggest Hunger Games fan, but Hunger Games does have some pretty interesting, even whether or not it completely works, it does have some interesting social-political commentary there. I just think that, you know, in terms of the films, they could have made that third film one film and not stretched it like they did, but that's me.
But the one thing I will say about Watkins, and I'll finish here, is that if you take a look at, like, the war game, you take a look at Culloden, you take a look at Privilege, Gladiators, Punishment Park, and Munch. Those are his first six films. I think he really, really pushed boundaries and really influenced a lot of other people. Now, you just sent me, and this is the latest one I saw, which is Free Thinker, or it's called Futsankaden, okay, from 1994. And as I said briefly, you know, there's all these different things happening. You know, is it a play? Is it a documentary? Is it this? You see all these things happening. And I'm saying to myself, well, Wes Anderson, when did you see this movie? Because if you've seen Asteroid City, he plays with that a lot. And this, of course, is 20, 30 years before this, you know, 28. You know, and I think we really, really do Watkins a disservice in terms of, like, saying that he had no influence. Or, you know, he's a mid-level, you know, director who did some real interesting things. I think he really, really has had an impact on particularly independent and more independent-minded bigger directors, even Soderbergh, you know, the sense of memory and the limey, I think, goes back to some things that he did, particularly in Privilege. You know, and that's just me. I you know, as I said before, I think Watkins is in my top 20 easily. I think he's just out of the top 10. And I've always appreciated him, and a part of that is because of the gut punch that I got when I first saw War Games. And I was just, like, blown away. So, you know, I mean, I'm so glad you let me on here and let me say these things, because I do feel that Watkins is underrepresented.
And I do want to say that this is one of those shows that I've been trying to slot Watkins in at some point since I started these director spotlights, since I decided to make these a regular part of the show. It's just been a matter of finding the right time and place. And I'm going to admit that the same things happened to my Alan Clark show that just keeps getting pushed back and back and back and back and back. There are certain directors that, yeah, they're known, but they're not known nearly enough. And I think, you know, that sometimes, you know, the semi-obscure directors are truly the interesting ones. You know, there's those guys and gals and such that nobody fucking knows about them, and they're awesome. And they're those people that, you know, are winning all the awards and making all the box office, and they're fine. But then there's guys like, you know, Alan Clark and Peter Watkins, who people know about them, but not enough people know about them. And if a show like tonight's episode can bring even a few dozen or hundred people to his work, I think that's something.
No, I agree.
He deserves to have a wider audience.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm done now.
Yep. So I'll go back to you, Aaron. Is there anything that you want to say to all this before we go?
Still good.
Still
okay.
Good? Okay. Well, do you have anything to add to what's coming up on Deviant Legion, or
Absolutely.
Shall I handle?
We have a couple things coming up. We're now in housekeeping. Unfortunately, last week my computer died, and we had to cancel some shows, and we had problems with Blog Talk, and that. So we had to. So I finally got two shows rescheduled. So first on Sunday, we're going to do, TC is going to do Rock This Town, and he's going to do 9 songs with King in the title and 9 songs with Queen in the title. And it's called Kings and Queens. So, you know, open up your ear holes and come join us for that. On Monday, we welcome filmmaker Trevor Younger, whose film The Man in Room 6 is currently on Tubi. I got a chance to watch about half of it. I need to finish it up. But it's a really, really good, solid psychological horror movie. And you should definitely check that out. On Tuesday, we bring back Keenan Walker. And Rachel and I will be with Keenan as we remember Paul Rubens, otherwise known as Pee Wee Herman. Keenan was very good friends with him, and we actually recorded this, but then Blog Talk didn't record it. So we're redoing that, and I do have to say that on the 11th, which is a week from this Monday, we welcome back one of our favorite micro-budget filmmakers, and that's Joel Weinkoop out of Tampa, Florida, and he's working on a whole series for the local PBS station down there on micro-budget filmmakers. And so we're going to be talking about that. He's got 4 films ready to go. The man is just insane, and we love him dearly. So we're going to have Joel on, and then we got a lot more coming, but I don't have that set up yet. So that's what we've got set up so far.
Well, coming up on Cathode Ray Mission in 2 weeks on the 15th, which is essentially going to be our 4th anniversary show. Yep, we've been doing this for 4 years, folks. An episode I'm calling The World of Jim Henson. It's going to focus on his TV work, but we're going to talk about the feature films he did, things like Dark Crystal, Labyrinth, the Muppet movies. But, you know, obviously this is going to be a look at the career of one of the most important creative individuals to ever hit television,
mm-hmm.
Period.
Oh, yeah.
So please join us for this. This is an episode, and I will disclose this here. When Carl and I were discussing this show being a thing, he asked me to come up with at least 10 or 12 ideas for shows, and this was one of those first 5 ideas I had for a show. I just didn't know when the fuck I was going to make it happen. And, well, it's finally happening. So, you know, I'm really, really pumped about this one. Now, 2 weeks, excuse me, I cannot talk tonight. 2 weeks after that, on the 29th, I have a look at a British miniseries called Wolf Hall. And, well, you know, we talked about Blog Talk messing up. That got deleted, my shelf. I'll have to reset that up. I just noticed that tonight as we were going into the show. I was like, oh, it got deleted. But it is indeed the episode we have scheduled for the 29th. So it will be Jim Henson in 2 weeks. And 2 weeks after that will be a look at Wolf Hall, a British miniseries about Anne Boleyn, Henry VIII, and, well, a very, very plotting man.
Nice.
not necessarily the best history, but wow, what acting. But we'll get into that when we discuss it. Aaron and I definitely have our feelings on that one. So that will be the work that's happening here on Cathode Ray Mission in our 4th anniversary month. So please come back and join us. And with that, I want to, of course, thank everyone out there for listening, both of you for coming on and doing this show, for participating. And now, on the count of three, one, two, three, good night.
Good night. Good night, everyone. Don't let the bed bugs bite.